We're back with Evan Handler here at the Dialect Coach's Corner. Evan, you've been very public about your battles with cancer. And your first book, Time on Fire, was a reflection of that experience. What effect did that have on the way that you communicate as a person and maybe even as an artist?
Well, I mean, I emerged at 28 to 30 years old after having been ripped from the life I was living with my peers at 24. So I had been isolated. I reemerged, getting used to the idea that there actually was a future that had seemed very questionable for a number of years. So there was a lot of isolation. There was a lot of, I mean, I got back into competing for jobs. I got back into dating. And the last 5 years' experience had been drastically different for me than for any of my peers.
Yes.
For any of the people that I knew up through 60 and 70 years old. I found that some of my frames of reference were certainly different than those people. But I really felt compelled. The storytelling grew out of two things. One, I felt there was this hidden society that I'd never seen represented the way I had experienced it. And I wanted to see a story told that represented what I saw, as opposed to all the kind of mythical fantasy versions I'd ever seen. I thought that maybe by telling people where I had been, that maybe that could act as a bridge. Because I did get a sense from the people I was around that they would kind of look at me askance and say, what the hell happened to this guy to make him the way he is? I didn't know what that is meant at the time. I mean, I didn't really realize at the time what a sort of seething, angry guy I was emerging from that experience. So, and it doesn't mean I was hitting people. Mm-hmm. I was being funny in a very dark, edgy way. In terms of that, it worked remarkably because I spent the next few years of my life telling that story and traveling widely to tell it and having it be received very, very well. And I know that I felt revealed, you know, in a way that normal conversation in a green room wouldn't reveal, or normal healthy dating conversation might not reveal. I mean, I remember, you know, handing some women my first book to read sometimes, or they would tell me that they'd read the book and say, well, you know, I read your book, now I feel like I read your diaries. You know, half jokingly suggest that they could give me theirs to read and then we'd be on even footing. And no one took me up on it. But that is a strange way to introduce yourself, but that's what I did. I mean, I became a guy who had this entity that existed that told my whole inner life and motivations for surviving and walking through some horrible hell that people would often read before meeting me.
Right.
Or shortly upon getting to know me. Oh, look, that guy's interesting. I'll read that book. And then you're getting to know someone when they've read your very carefully crafted version of what you want people to think about what you went through. Because that was another motivating part for it for me. People are going to make determinations about what I went through and what they think it must have done to me and what it must mean to me. I could craft a version for public consumption that would tell people what I wanted them to know and think about what I had gone through and what it meant to me.
Right.
And that was pretty successful in its own way. I'll also say that I learned from that and from all the interviews that flowed from it that no matter how carefully you think you've crafted the message, no matter how precisely you think you've learned, you've used the language, people will see it, interpret it through the prism of their own minds and experience and turn it into whatever altered, convoluted, and perverted version suits them. So you can never win that battle. You can try with all your might, and it's still going to be interpreted through the prism of every reader's and listener's mind.
When you are communicating, because that's really what you're saying that you were using that as a communication tool.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a battle to be won?
Sure, the answer is yes, obviously. I mean, people win wars, you know, using communication tools.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that you're going to, you know, have the precisely desired effect on every single individual it lands upon.
Mm-hmm.
It means that maybe you'll be able to craft a message that takes hold and has some degree of effect, and maybe you won't. Maybe you'll succeed, maybe you'll fail, but that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be people who read it and think, what a load of crap this is, or, you know, this is not an insightful, justified howl of anger. This is, as some people responded to my first book, the whinings of an overprivileged survivor. So you can certainly blanket your message and have a certain amount of effect. It's just not going to be 100%.
Clearly, you feel like people judged you based on their perception of this communication.
Every piece of written material is a form of propaganda of one kind or another. It's somebody who has something they want to say to either have some desired effect or to put a certain message across. We had these conversations when I went to Yaddo and Artists and Writers Colony, the people who would say that there is no such thing as nonfiction because everybody puts an editorial spin on everything. And I take issue with that drastic a read on it, you know, but I get their point. But I also realized from your question that that I do tremendously. I think it's the major way that I actually judge and categorize people is through their communication. You know, I think ethnically, racially, you know, I'm a pretty flatlined, blindish guy, but the way people speak and present themselves actually has a tremendous effect on my snap judgments and categorizations. That if there's a prejudice that exists within me, it is for people who don't communicate well or who have obvious educational or class differences than me, that I, it's not that I condemn them, it's not like, I hate that person, but I do categorize them.
I want to talk to you a little bit about humor. Now, you performed in many comedies, on stage, on screen. You've played one of the Three Stooges, an icon. How would you describe the kind of humor that you enjoy?
My first gigs in New York, and I think what I was the go-to guy for, was actually throw a tantrum dramatic guy. I mean, the first Broadway show I did that I remember talking to you about back then was they let an actor go 4 days before opening from a play called Solomon's Child. Heavy dramatic stuff that I probably performed, you know, with the equivalent of a sledgehammer. I just think it became clear to me pretty quickly that everything's better when you find humor in it. Everywhere you can find ironic truths of human existence, you should try to put them in.
Great comedy, they say, has some kind of, comic engine or a point of view that drives it forward. What are some of the things that you might look for in a text to help you figure out what that is?
You know, one of the things that I knew from a young age, wanting to be an actor, that made me think I'm in the right place, was then confirmed again and again, quotes of Jason Robards or whatever, was, you know, I'm interested in finding truthful moments of human existence that are recognizable to other humans.
Yeah.
Any writer worth their salt should be writing from motivations. And that's the beautiful stuff to work on, because then you know, well, this dialogue all works because it's all, the writer knew what they were doing and the writer's talking about human motivations. Now, to me, it's a very funny scene if the dialogue has nothing to do with the guy wanting to get out of his room. Then it's an even more elevated level of comedy.
Yes.
When it's really just discussing something that's going on at work as he keeps on trying to get you to leave and you keep on getting more and more and more comfortable.
I've known you for a long time, and when I think of you as a young man, a very young man, now you have so much more vocal and articulative energy than I remember from that time when we were in school together and even after. First of all, would you agree with me? And if so, how do you explain that?
It's a little surprising to me to hear you say that. But I think I know why, but I have a different memory, but I think probably you mean just in terms of
your actual performance style.
Oh, I mean, as an actor?
As an actor,
okay.
Yes.
I have tried. I mean, I still think I fall short. I mean, I look at guys who I think accomplish things that I always thought I would accomplish, but really haven't, and they have. And it's always an interesting thing to me. I think, well, but wait a minute. I know I can do that, but yet I'm not doing it. So does that mean I can't do it? Is that the definition of not being able to? Because you could be a Major League Baseball player who watches other guys hit and go, I see that guy hitting the curveball and I know I can do that. And then you get to the plate and you don't hit it.
Right.
So it doesn't matter how much you feel like you could hit it. But, you know, if I see Paul Giamatti in something like Sideways.
Yes.
Brings such a range of physical postures and, you know, high-pitched vocal squeals and just, you know, he's just very alive, you know, whatever. That is stuff that I have had to really consciously watch people. And then when I'm doing something, try to break myself out of my lack of inclination to bring as much
right.
to it, as much energy, as mm-hmm. much variety.
Right.
So, and that's a very awkward thing to try to actually artificially inject energy and variety into what you do. I have to constantly remind myself not only to raise the stakes, but then also to let that have a physical and vocal effect.
Yes.
And to show the results of that. You know, I did a production of Master Harold and the Boys, toured with Zakes Mokai. And I auditioned several times for Ethel Fugard, the author, who was also going to be the director of the tour. And I remember Ethel coming to me one time and giving me notes afterwards before opening in Boston. And I said to him something that I've had in mind to say to many directors many times. I said, Ethel, you know, that's exactly what I have in my mind. You know, that's really what I think I'm doing. And Ethel said, well, I've got eyes and I've got ears, man. There's a very, very succinct lesson there.
Yes, yes.
I have to see it or I have to hear it. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what's in your head. So it has been a long-term mission and struggle for me, I think, to try to free myself up to be more and more demonstrative and expressive in those ways. And I think the comedy helped a lot.
I know you're a real lover of great music, and you were really into Dylan back in the day, and I'm sure you still are. What sort of effect do the musical artists that you love have on you?
It really frees me physically, certainly. I listen to a lot less music than I used to, but I do like the linguistic stuff, you know, and the Dylan stuff I still listen to. And it's interesting because I've had so many different relationships and women who've come along and listened to it and said, but I don't even know what he's talking about. You know, right. What is that? True, that's a good question. You know, I was listening to Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands earlier today. I love it, but it's all about his inflections, really, and imagery. He's not telling a story that I can recognize, and I don't know what her Arabian drum is. You know, I don't know if anybody does.
Right.
But he, in particular, has always been iconic to me. And when we're talking about a relationship with a microphone, I've been fascinated by the difference between his studio performances and live performances. Because there was once upon a time, if you watch the old concert footage from long ago, where he was precise and articulate and very highly stylized. I'm not talking about the Dylan caricatured imitation that people do. I'm talking about very precise syllabic stresses and extensions that he would do in the most delicate of fashions. And there was a guy at the height of some of his youthful, creative expressions, singing in a way that nobody had really done before. And in later performances live, certainly it's, to me, a lot messier and sloppier. It's not what it was back then.
Right.
But I remember saying to Harold Guskin, who's a well-known Shakespeare coach and acting coach, okay, so I've learned the iambic pentameter. I get that, you know, a certain school believes it was written to say, with the emphasis provided by Shakespeare, because it ba-bum, 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 right? But could you do it like Bob Dylan sung his earlier songs? Like, what if you decided, I'm going to play a great Shakespearean role, and I'm going to stretch it and twist it, and not because I don't know how to do it in a traditional way, and not because I'm just, you know, a Marlon Brando who just has my vocal patterns and doesn't alter them, but like, really, you know, make it an Allen Ginsberg poem.
Right.
As spoken by Allen Ginsberg.
What can you say about how theatrical style has changed, how film style has changed in terms of just the way actors are using their bodies, their voices, and their articulation to communicate things?
I don't know if I'm going to have great insight into that. I mean, I don't have such a cataloged memory, so I'm not sure what the 70s or 80s were. I know that I often will look at certain films and think, oh, instantly, that looks like a movie. You know, this kind of movie looks like life, and this kind of movie looks like a movie. And what is that quality of lighting and sound that instantly makes it seem artificial versus the films that are striving for shadow and fog and a different kind of nuance? You know, I'm a big fan of the multi-camera sitcom style when it's done well.
Yes.
Something that people have said until recently is dead and can never come back because it's too artificial and people don't like it. But I watch Seinfeld reruns. I still think All in the Family is about the best thing ever done. I think almost everything's in the execution. I don't know, I'm flashing back now on something I said earlier of people who have to work hard to push something out versus people who have a kind of command within them. You know, Sam Jackson is a guy whose energy and vocal quality to me is beautiful and fascinating and so full. I mean, that's Sam's nature in a lot of ways.
Yes.
That Sam is a forceful, effusive, ebullient, you know, very full creature. But I'm not sure that Sam has to remind himself to pump it out and forward. You know what I mean? I think Sam knows his beats and knows his intentions and knows what he wants to convey, and then it's conveyed very strongly.
Yes. You know, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us here on the podcast. It was great. It's really wonderful for me to give everyone listening a little taste of what I've been able to enjoy about the conversations that we've had over the years. And I hope that you'll be able to come back and we'll be able to do it again. We didn't get nearly enough done.
All right. No problem. Thanks, man.
And if we had a studio audience, they'd be on their feet right now putting their hands together for Evan Handler.
Except they think I was Howie Mandel.
Thank you for tuning in to the Dialect Coaches Podcast. I'm Jerome Butler, your dialect coach. And to paraphrase the immortal Zig Ziglar, motivation is like bathing. It's recommended every day.